From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, why the Zablocki VA Medical Center and UWM make such good partners in providing veterans with both health and educational services.
Then, as the trend of raising backyard chickens grows in Milwaukee, one local business owner has made it her mission to help.
I try to make it easy and take all the guesswork out for people, because what I found is what you read on the internet is pretty scary, and it usually doesn't happen. It isn't like that.
Plus, a new children's book examines a lesser-known local bee that's a major pollinator.
One mason bee can pollinate as many flowers as 100 honeybees, which is why it's so important to think of these pollinators when it comes to, you know, if our honeybees die out, they are our main pollinators, but they don't have to be.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. For the past few years, the Zablocki VA teams up with the Military and Veterans Resource Center at UWM to hold a mental health summit. The sixth annual summit will take place this Saturday, and it focuses on African-American veterans.
The summit will have presentations featuring a variety of topics, including racial trauma and inequality, African-centered approaches to healing, and the disparities found in African-American healthcare.
William Johnson is the Minority Veterans Program Coordinator at the Zablocki VA, and Jane Holland is the interim director at the Military and Veterans Resource Center at UWM. They joined us in the studio to tell us more, and Holland begins by explaining how the two organizations began cooperating.
UWM's Military and Veterans Resource Center, or the MAVRIC, as we call it, we've been partnering with the VA Medical Center on a number of projects over the past few years, and the VA's mobile vet van visits the campus regularly. They're there 3 days a month in the fall and spring semesters, and many UWM graduates go on to work at the VA Medical Center when they graduate. So it just kind of came together naturally when about 3 years ago, when the VA was looking for a partner to help them host the VA Mental Health Summits. And we've been doing it now. This is the third year.
One of the things I found most interesting is UWM, I think, has the highest number of veterans as students in the entire UW system. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, we have more military and veteran students than any other four-year university in the six states surrounding Wisconsin, in addition to having more than in the UW system.
And so, William, for you, getting to work with a partner like UWM must be a good thing to reach out into the community.
Absolutely. For the Milwaukee VA, we are always looking to reach out with partners who will provide access to veterans. And there is a huge cohort of veterans at UWM. And what we are constantly trying to do is engage the veterans where they are. And the possibility of reaching that cohort at the university has been great for us.
And so this year, you're focusing on African-American veterans. What are the specific challenges that African-American vets face that the other parts of the veteran population don't?
I would say more than anything, it is communication. It is not that this cohort faces different pathologies than any other group, but we would say the knowledge of what the VA has available is maybe not as available to this group of veterans. There are lots of misperceptions perhaps about the VA and the African American community. I mean, there are things you can list going back to the history of VA, which maybe has put some people off from participating with VA. But the Milwaukee VA is committed to excellence and committed to providing the best possible care that we can. We have a very long history. We're one of the first three VAs in the whole United States. And as a workforce, we are committed to serve veterans. And that is throughout the place.
I have to say, when I go there, because I'm a veteran too, and I get care there, I see a wonderfully mixed group of veterans walking the halls. It's not all white faces. It's not all male faces. It's a mix of everybody. And so something seems to be working.
Absolutely. We feel that out in the culture, there is a kind of conversation that is sometimes tribal. But in the VA, we have one creed, and it's about those heroes who have sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. We serve the people whose creed was freedom. You know, the ones who defend our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And that is the biggest cohort that we want to serve. So out in the public, we divide by races and all of that. But inside, we want it to be just one tribe. And so by reaching out to the specific group, we're trying to get them into the VA, to get them to know all the services that perhaps they have missed or don't know are available. And that is the function of this summit for the VA participation. Each year, we've tried to reach out to a specific group and hoping that they would know the availability of services at the Milwaukee VA.
And so, Jane, for Maverick, what are some of the things that you hope that your student veterans get from this summit?
You know, it's interesting. The average age of our student veteran is 30 years old at UWM, so it's not the younger traditional age students. So these are veterans that have either served for 4 to 6 years or longer. And so many of them have not applied for their benefits that they are eligible for and that they earned when they're in the military. So we hope to get this information to them that this is something that we're making it easy for them. Actually, we're bringing people there on campus that can get them registered and get them able to use in their benefits.
So that's interesting. People don't know that they can apply for the VA. Are they're mustering out and not realizing that they have benefits due them?
We find that in every cohort from every wartime period, we find veterans not realizing all that the VA has to offer. We find veterans every outreach sometimes that don't realize even for VA home loan or home loan guarantee, or that they are eligible for medical care or VA burial, the processes that are services that are foundational service for our Milwaukee VA and for the national VA system. People just don't know what is available. And that's why we have to keep going out. And specifically, as a minority veterans program coordinator, our job is to do targeted outreach to these specific cohorts to bring them in to the creed of the VA.
Do you find that the VA still suffers from negative press? Do people out in the community who don't already use the VA think, it's too much. I can't deal with it. It's not very good. Whatever the negative thing is, are you still fighting that?
It is an absolute concern. I would say up until a few years ago, we were kind of off limits for these kinds of attacks. But here recently, we would have to admit that we've become kind of low-hanging fruit. And as a way of blunting against that process, we are trying to get the data out, specifically the data points related to the quality of service that we provide, the number of unique visits. For instance, in the national VA system, in a day, there are over 250,000 unique office visits. The system is that big. So we hear of isolated incidents of persons missing a visit or having to delay. But when you consider the scale of the system, it is minuscule. Now, if I'm that veteran who missed an appointment, of course I'm concerned. But you have to consider the whole of the system. We are the largest delivery system in the United States as far as medical care.
So if someone is hearing about this for the first time when this broadcast happens, what can they expect if they show up? So I'll start. Either one of you can jump in on that. What's happening during the day?
Well, we wanted to look at specifically African-American culture. We wanted to talk about things that were concerns to the population of African-Americans that are in Milwaukee, but also to the greater history of our culture. That's one of the reasons why we have a theme that says pulling from the past to change the future. We want to acknowledge the whole process of coming to America and the experience even out of slavery. We want to be a part because that's still a part of our existence. But we want to take an assessment and look at the data points of where we are as veterans now and what is available for going to the future. What are the things that the VA has to offer that will improve the lives of our veterans? You know, the average veteran comes back from war and goes about their business. They are not broken, but we have this concept that all the veterans who come back are needing the VA. It is not so. But those who come to us, we want to make sure that they know what is available so that they can move forward and have good, productive citizenry.
And so how is that going to happen on this day?
Well, so there'll be lots of different types of breakout sessions. We'll also have a couple of really great, interesting speakers. The first speaker is Delphine Metcalf-Foster, and she is the first woman and the first African-American to serve as national commander for the Disabled American Veterans Organization. So she'll be our morning keynote speaker. And then in the afternoon, we have Reggie Jackson. And Reggie Jackson is the head griot or docent of America's Black Holocaust Museum, located right here in Milwaukee. And then some of the other breakout sessions will, of course, have plenty of folks there, and a breakout session just focused on eligibility for VA health care and other benefits that vets may not know that they do qualify for. There'll also be a breakout session talking about racial trauma and inequality. Another one on chronic pain management, African-centered approaches to healing, disparities in African-American healthcare, gun violence as a public health issue, and then dementia and Alzheimer's care, all topics that we surveyed the African-American community, both with churches, organizations, and focus groups, to find out what were the issues that they really wanted to know about and how can the VA help in these areas. And so these are the ones that everyone came back and said, yeah, we'd like to know more about these issues.
And so if a veteran is coming, should they bring their DD-214 if they aren't already part of the VA system?
They should absolutely. If they are concerned whether or not they are eligible, we will have persons there who will look at eligibility for VA services, whether it be health care or general benefits or compensation and pension. All of that will be available. We want to make sure we can provide, again, the maximum number of services that are available at the VA in this one opportunity, kind of one-stop shopping.
Once this is over, though, what's the next step? If somebody misses this, is like, I'm out of town, I can't go, what should they do? Should they come to the VA?
They should always come to the VA. You know, if you have questions, come to the VA, because we have people who will guide you through the process, determine your eligibility. And if you are a veteran, and if there are things that you are perhaps not eligible for at the VA, there are other community partners that we know that can provide a service. You know, we have a process now where we do not allow veterans, if they come to us, to sleep, like, outside. If a veteran comes to us, even in late in the afternoon, we will have that veteran sleeping under a shelter and with hot meals that night. That hasn't always been the case, but we are committed to those sorts of things. And that's, you know, that's one of the outreaches that we want veterans to know that is available.
And then also in the afternoon on Saturday, there will be a lot of these VA resources and community resources that will be there at the summit at UWM, so that they can speak with people if they have some questions, whether it might be mental health services or other types of therapies that are available.
Right. For instance, say right now it's a big thing with addictions. The VA as a foundational treatment, foundational service is our drug rehabilitation. We have spent in the last year over $1 million upgrading the security of our domiciliary, where we have 100 and I think it's about 150 beds for treatment. This is a service that I want to say we processed and graduated more than 200 veterans in the last year with substance abuse treatment and services.
And the other thing, Jane, is that if veterans are interested in academic programs, that would be something else, I assume, that they can find out on Saturday.
Sure. If they have questions about whether they have education benefits left or if they are eligible for additional, because a lot of people don't know that now we have the Wisconsin GI Bill, that maybe they used up their post 9/11, or maybe they were on the Montgomery or something else. But now the Wisconsin GI Bill is, they might be eligible for that. So we'll have folks there that can help them find out about that.
And there are so many services at the VA that are not necessarily education. I mean, we provide, you know, we have yoga, we have Zentangle, we have a plethora of services that would just get people engaged, because engagement breeds good mental health. And that is a foundational process of VA.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much for coming in and telling us about it. Jane and William, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
William Johnson is the Minority Veterans Program Coordinator at the Zablocki VA, and Jane Holland is the Interim Director at the Military and Veterans Resource Center at UWM.
The 6th Annual VA Mental Health Summit will take place this Saturday at UWM Student Union. You can find more information at wuwm.com.
adolescence can really just suck. From the acne to the ACTs, it's fair to say that most of us are happy to leave those days behind us.
But essayist Marnie Mominga found herself returning to one such teenage experience when she decided to get braces at the age of 65.
Like a pair of chest-gear cats, we grinned at each other. Free at last from an assortment of instruments probing our mouths, the two of us simultaneously popped up from the clutching confines of our reclined orthodontic chairs and smiled our first smile with braces. Hers were attention-grabbing pink. Mine were attempted camouflage tones of white and silver. Pert and pretty, she looked to be about 13. Gray and grateful, I was 65. Regardless, we high-fived each other. "Done," I said. "Love the pink." "Thanks," she beamed back, surprised no doubt to be facing a grandmother of six with braces on her teeth. But not as surprised as I was the minute the euphoria subsided. What had I just done? For a moment, time stood still, and I remembered being a young teenager just like her. The year was 1965. "Fangs," my boyfriend had called my teeth. I married him anyway. But he was right. I begged my father to get my teeth straightened. No easy task in a family of seven struggling to make ends meet. Nevertheless, due to his true nature, he scrimped and saved and worked out a payment plan with the orthodontist. The end result was a smile that lasted 50 years. Lo, these many years later, however, my teeth decided to regain their youth and march right back to their teenage positions. The fangs came back with a vengeance and then some. And the worst of it was, I didn't want to smile anymore. "Am I too old to get my teeth straightened?" I asked my dentist at my next visit. "Too vain?" "I don't think so," he smiled kindly. "I'll refer you to an orthodontist for a consultation." But I hemmed and hawed for over a year, too nervous and doubtful to even call for an appointment. In that time period, however, my teeth only got worse. When I looked at my photos from my niece's wedding, I cringed. It didn't take long to pick up the phone and make an appointment. "Too old and vain?" I asked the orthodontist after a series of x-rays and exams. "How old are you?" he asked. 65, and I had braces before at 15. "Look here," he answered, showing me his bottom teeth lined with metal wire. "I'm 66, so that makes me older and vainer than you." I signed on the spot. Some folks go for facelifts. I opted for braces. And yet, as I exited my orthodontic chair that morning, I wasn't so sure. My teeth ached and felt like they were wearing a cage. And in a way, they were. This for the next 14 months? 50 years ago, my braces were heavy metal affairs that resembled Frankenstein hardware. Now, at least, they were slimmer and lighter and not as throbbing as in my youth when I would lie awake at night, unable to sleep from the pain after a bracket tightening. Nevertheless, my new braces took some getting used to. Smaller bites of food, brushing and flossing constantly, avoiding nuts and spinach and anything else that had a tendency to coat my wires like a salad. It also took a while to learn not to spit every time I spoke. You would have thought I'd lose some weight. Nada. Perhaps harder than those adjustments were the surprised looks I got every time I came face to face with friends and acquaintances for the first time. Although I was embarrassed, those I greeted were not. "I've thought about doing that myself," said more than one adult. "I got braces when I was 50, confided a doctor. "My lowers were straightened at age 73, beamed a retired science teacher. Surprisingly, I was not alone in my quest for a better senior citizen smile. I just hoped I didn't die with these brackets on and would live long enough for my investment to pay off. Of course, by the time I finally decided to get braces, events of a lifetime sprang up on the calendar like a dragonfly hatch. And so, as the photos well attest, I celebrated my 45th wedding anniversary, my husband's 50th high school reunion, our son's wedding, my brother's wedding, and as an author, a batch of public speaking engagements, all with braces gleaming. And yet, if I'd waited for the perfect moment, I never would have done it. Finally, only 3 more months are left, and this now 66-year-old is grinning from ear to ear. For despite my reservations, the time flew. The orthodontic staff was consistently gentle and encouraging, and ironically, I've turned out to be a walking advertisement for senior citizens wanting to explore their own orthodontic options. But best of all, my teeth are almost straight, and for that, I feel as giddy as the tooth fairy on a midnight haul. I might not be 15 again, but... but I'm smiling as though I were.
Lake Effect essayist Marnie Mominga is the author of several books, including Return to Wake Robin and On a Clear Night. You can hear her past essays at WUWM.com.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll take a look at a local business helping backyard chicken farmers in Milwaukee. More of that when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Last week, we spoke with writer Carolyn Washburn about the growing popularity of beekeeping and backyard chicken coops in the Milwaukee area. As laws governing urban farming have evolved around the area, more and more people have joined in on the trend.
And this comes as good news for Karen Krumenacher. She's the owner of Royal Roost, a local consulting service that offers to help backyard chicken farmers like herself. Krumenacher started the business more than 20 years ago at a time when keeping chickens in the city of Milwaukee was illegal.
Luckily for her, she lives in Pewaukee, which is where I met up with her. Joined by Lake Effect intern Ben Binversi, I headed out to the Roost to see just what it takes to be a backyard chicken farmer. Even before you started consulting with people, what got you interested in chickens?
I think what it was is we moved out here from Milwaukee out to the beautiful Lake Country living area, and I was pregnant with my oldest, my first, and you know, here we are. It didn't look anything like this. It was all wooded, and we had a Cocker Spaniel, and I thought, geez, you know, as much as we like being out, you know, beyond those woods was kind of scary. I wasn't sure what was out there, so I said, I think if I'm out here, it'd be nice to have ducks or chickens or something. So that back then is when Martha Stewart still had her like living program that was on primetime TV, which I was obsessed with watching. I watched her with a flock of 300 Americanas, which is how she got started with Sherwin-Williams, the painting business, because they lay eggs that are different shades of cream, khaki, brown, rose-colored, green-colored. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can do that. I can raise chickens. So it wasn't much of an afterthought. We headed up, went to Merton Feed Mill, because starting in February through the end of August, they carry all different breeds of chicks, pheasants, ducklings, goslings, guinea hens, you name it. So we went there and we picked up our first chicks and haven't looked back.
What happened, you know, more than 20 years ago that you went, this is something I want to do?
What happened is my husband is a patent attorney, and once my youngest was in school, he's like, all right, what kind of invention with chicken raising, backyard, kind of tool can you come up with? And I happened to be at Merton Feed Mill, who I have a great relationship with. That's who I get all my feed with. I was in there getting my supplies, and a guy came in and said, hey, Greg, I think I want to get into this chicken raising. What do I got to do? Well, Greg doesn't have 30 minutes of his time to, you know, fill the guy in and everything he needs, what to do. I hopped in my Suburban, was driving home, and the light bulb went on. And I was like, hey, I could be a chicken consultant. And so I came home, I chatted with my best friend. We came up with a logo, we put it together, website was created, and here I am. Obviously it was slow to start because it's such a niche, one-of-a-kind business. Actually, when I started it, it was just kind of on that cusp of being a trend, the chicken raising. So as any business, small little business, you're constantly reinventing yourself, what you can do. Because when you're passionate about something, you really want to make it work. And I didn't want it to be a hobby. I wanted it to be a business.
20 years ago, of course, raising chickens in Milwaukee wasn't actually legal.
Yeah, no. They passed it, I think, like a year or two after I started the business.
Okay.
Wauwatosa came on board. There's various municipalities that are all on board now with chicken raising.
As you've seen, like, the changes happening, you know, in really the legal status of keeping chickens, yeah. have you seen interest in it grow?
Yes. Oh, I think right now it's kind of at a high plateau. More urban agriculture, people are really concerned and interested, especially with young children, where their food is coming from, what is in their food. You know, a lot of people eat eggs. So I always consider chickens the pet with benefits. Great pets, but then yet you get an egg from them. So what a perfect pet.
Yeah.
So these are bantams. This is as big as they get. They're full size. So these are actually kind of perfect for city dwelling chicken raisers. They lay smaller eggs, but I actually think they produce eggs a little bit quicker than that 24 to 36 hour period. So I highly recommend something like this, you know, especially City of Milwaukee that has the ordinance for four versus the big standards like
yeah.
that.
The more classic chicken.
Yes. Yep. But those guys are pretty cute. It's fun to watch them. There's two roosters in there, so they're kind of the watch out for the girls. Very cute to watch them frolic around and interact with each other. And the boys will find bugs or grubs for the girls, and then they'll call them over and pretend like they're eating them, but they're not. Then they let the girls take over. This is Mr. Rockstar Handsome Turks. He is our heritage breed, Blue Slate. If anybody follows me on Facebook, they'll see Turks a lot. I take him to events. He was just out at Stonebank Farm Market last night. They had pizza night, and they asked if I'd bring him out. And he just, wherever there's people, he's there.
So I'm seeing a lot of these holes chickens are kind of sitting in.
They are getting deeper and deeper. So this is perfect. She's doing what's called dust bathing. Mm. To maintain their healthy feathers, they need to seek out natural dirt, and they kind of pack it around their feathers. And it's cooling as well, feels good. You know, just like when we shower and bathe, this is what they do in the dirt. And then they come out and they kind of shake and fluff, and you'll see dust go flying. But it is very important that they do that to maintain their healthy feathers.
So if you're someone who has a chicken coop in the city,
yes.
What kind of environment do you need? Because they need to dig a hole like this. They need to be able
to... They need to have access to dirt. It should be like a 50-50 split of sun and shade. They don't need a lot of space. See the size of this coop?
Yeah, it's about the size of a child's playhouse.
As far as even outrun, it should just be kind of this area that includes a coop and a fenced-in run-in area for them to keep them contained. But they don't need a lot of space, especially if you get the right breeds. That's kind of key, is know your breeds. Know your breeds that are non-flighty, non-aggressive, good egg layers, winter-hardy. These are all important factors when you want to dive into chicken raising. That's why I started the business. So not that I'm a know-it-all by any means, but I try to make it easy and take all the guesswork out for people, because what I found is what you read on the internet is pretty scary, and it usually doesn't happen. It isn't like that.
Now, when you say kind of scary, what are the kinds of things that people end up reading?
As far as... mites, lice, you know, avian flu kind of things, salmonella. They're simple preventative measures that you can take in maintaining your healthy, friendly flock that doesn't necessarily pertain to what you're reading that's happening in year-round climates. It's different here.
So you have the Americanas, you have the lovely Turks here.
Yes, but and then there's some ducks.
Yeah, so what kinds of ducks? Do you get eggs from the ducks?
Or? We do, and actually right now we have some very broody females that just love to stockpile the eggs, but we've done enough of the natural hatchling of ducklings that we just now take them, and I use them for baking or whatnot.
Nice.
So, yeah.
What's the difference between the eggs?
Duck eggs are a thicker, creamier consistency, really preferred for baking. Okay. You know, it's just like a fresh egg. If you have ever had fresh eggs, they actually have a flavor versus your store-bought. You know, my yolks are orange. They're not, you know, a matted, muted yellow. They're pretty much orange. And it's because the chickens naturally forage on bugs and grubs and weeds that just add to a higher protein content.
Now, if you're someone who's interested in maybe having ducks instead of chickens, what is that like?
I don't recommend, because ducks really are obsessed with water. They do something called face washing, where they get their bills in there and then they snort it out. It's just really messy. They're hard to keep in the winter. They take a bit longer to lay their eggs versus a chicken. They start to lay eggs anywhere between 4 to 6 months old, most breeds. Ducks are usually more 5+ months, could be even up to 7-8 months old. But yeah, that water thing is a for real thing, and it just gets to be kind of messy.
So harder for especially urban dwellers.
Yes.
Now, what are the biggest mistakes when it comes to raising chickens in an urban environment? What are the biggest mistakes that you see people making?
You know, it's easy to kind of get out of hand because it really is. Raising 2 to 4 chickens is nothing. It's easy. We started out with 4. The next year, we immediately went to 8 because they really don't require a lot of care and maintenance. Really, that's kind of it. I mean, everything with urban agriculture is awesome these days. I mean, chicken raising and gardening, beekeeping, it just makes sense that they all go together.
What are the biggest questions that you get from people when they're looking to get into keeping chickens in their yards, that they go, I'm really not sure how to navigate this part of it?
The biggest thing is predators. And the biggest predator you really have to deal with is going to be a hawk, because they're mostly out during the day. Here on our property, these tall pines, we have a nest in that tree and we have a nest down the way. They're red-tailed hawks. The worst time really is in the spring when they're feeding their young. They have their young in February and March. But as far as the coyote and fox, you know, they're all roamers. They're not territorial and they're more nocturnal. So at night, your chickens are cooped up in their cute little house. They're not out and about. I mean, you will have those strange situations, which don't happen that awesome or frequently, that a coyote could be roaming through, or a fox den is somewhere close and they get a whiff of chicken or hear the crowing or something. Sure, then they may be showing up. But I would not let that deter you from all the happiness that comes out of backyard chicken raising.
Now, of course, you have roosters here. Yes. If you're someone who's in the city of Milwaukee, you're not legally allowed to have roosters.
Right, exactly.
What is the benefit of having a rooster versus just having the chickens?
Roosters are kind of your watchdog. So as far as predators, the hawk's doing a flyby, they're going to let out a call like a, and that's kind of a siren for the girls. And I've seen it many times. They go running for the shrubs, something to take cover, and he'll still kind of be out there watching what the hawk's going to do. So he's a good watchdog for the girls. Like I previously mentioned, he'll be off, and if he finds something for the girls to eat on, he lets them know, but he doesn't partake himself. So he's very gentlemanlike to the girls, which is awesome to observe.
Do you have any questions that you'd like to add, Ben?
It seems like they're coexisting pretty peacefully now. Do you ever have any spats between the animals, or which ones maybe don't get along? Because I've seen dogs.
Great question.
And chickens. Sometimes it doesn't mix.
Yeah, that pecking order is a real thing. So, like in my case right now, so I have my rental chickens, which are my 5-month-old birds, mingling with my over a year-old birds. And they always are reestablishing pecking order. Who's more dominant? Who's more submissive? But here at my place, you gotta commingle and get along. And for the most part, it's very successful for us. So I think it's because they have ample room to mingle, but again, it's breeds too. Know your breeds. I know a lot of people like to get all the various breeds. They are gorgeous and fun to look at, but then you're going to probably be getting into more issues and kind of maybe some damage as far as, you know, losing feathers or whatnot. So, yeah, great question. Yeah, Turks, he gets along with everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody gets along with Turks.
Karen Krumenacher is the owner of Royal Roost, a local consulting service for backyard chicken farmers. To see photos of some of the animals, including the famous Turks, head to WUWM.com.
One last break, then. In honor of Pollinator Week, we take a look at one of our most efficient pollinators, the mason bee. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. It is National Pollinator Week, a time when we take time to celebrate the bugs and animals that make our world bloom. There is a lot of talk about the many dangers facing pollinators, particularly bees.
But when we talk about bees, we tend to focus on just one type. Honeybees. In fact, honeybees and other kinds of social bees make up just 2% of the more than 20,000 different types of bees in the world.
A new book for kids is calling attention to some of these lesser-known bees, namely the mason bee. The aptly named Turn This Book Into a Beehive includes 20 different experiments and invites you to literally turn the pages of that book into a hive for local bees.
Author Lynn Brunel was in Milwaukee for a series of events in the area last month, and she joined me in studio. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So I think the most astonishing thing first reading your book was just the fact that most bees aren't social.
Yeah, I know. That blew me away, too. Because I think when most people think of bees, they think of honeybees, right? They think of the queen bee, and they all live in a hive, and they make honey, and then if you get too close, they sting you. Well, it turns out only 7 species of the 20,000 species of bees are honeybees.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy? But I think it just sort of shows, too, that that's our human interest in them because they produce honey. These other bees, they don't make honey. They're amazing pollinators, and they're going to be, I think, our saviors in the future, but they don't make honey.
So tell me about some of these solitary bees. What kind of bees are considered solitary?
So they're called solitary because they don't live in a hive. The ones that are in a hive that live socially, meaning one queen with all the worker bees, that's social. Solitary, every girl's a queen. And every female is sort of like a single mom. She finds the house, she gets the food, she lays the egg, she builds a wall, she does all that stuff on her own. The solitary bees will live near each other. But not in the same place. Sort of like they like, you know, condos next door to each other. So like when you set up when you create a hive for them, like with these tubes that they like, they'll all come in and they'll all live happily near each other. But each tube belongs to one particular female bee. It's cool.
And those bees are specifically called mason bees.
Mason bees, because they use mud to spackle these walls in between to make these little compartments in the tubes. So a pile of food, lay an egg on the top of the pile of food, and build a wall. Get another pile of food, lay an egg on that, build another wall so that the straw-like container will have, you know, 10 to 12 little compartments, and the egg will eat the food, then create a cocoon around itself and winter over, and then in the spring, chew out of its cocoon, chew out of the mud wall, and fly out and start the whole thing all over again.
Now, this book, Turn This Book Into a Beehive, can in fact be turned into a hive for these mason bees.
Yeah, so I looked up the word hive because I liked the title so much when I was like, oh my gosh, turn this book into a beehive. It's like a transformer. I love it. And then I thought, but I can't say hive because they're not making honey. Well, I looked up the word hive, and hive just means a man-made structure built to house bees. So it totally is a hive.
It completely is a hive, yeah.
But, I mean, again, when we think about it in terms of honeybees, honeybees are domesticated, right? They were all brought over from Europe. They're not wild. Whereas these solitary bees, they're all wild. They're just wild and roaming free. So when you build a structure for them that looks appealing to them, they will make it their home. Whereas a honeybee hive, those were man-made structures in order to hold honeybees, you know, in order to be able to use their honey and their honeycomb.
Yeah. So there's the mason bee, but then there are a few other types of bees that live in completely different structures.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I mean, if you think about it, with 20,000 different species of bees, you know, and only 7 of them honeybees, there are carpenter bees. They like to dig into wood and live in wooden holes. There are miner bees, and they like to dig into the soil. There are leafcutter bees. They live in these sort of tubes, too, these little skinnier versions of the tubes, and they don't dig for mud and make the walls. They actually chew up leaves and make a kind of a paper wall. And there's huge bees. There's, you know, bees the size of your thumb, and then there's bees the size of a fingernail paring. You know, they're all over the place.
I remember a while back I was planting an herb garden, and there were these little black things that were flying around, and a friend of mine was like, "Those are bees." I said, "Those can't be bees." And they were coming out of the soil. They were these tiny little guys that were coming out of the soil. What and when I read your book, I went, "Oh, those he was very right. Those were bees."
Those are bees, yeah.
What kind of misconceptions do you get from, and not just adults like me, but the kids who you work with when you're talking to them about these bees?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is, you know, my own misconceptions of them before I wrote the book. You know, if I heard a buzzing sound, I was running in the opposite direction. Now I hear a buzzing sound and I'm like, what are you? Where are you going? What are you landing on? One of the, you know, the misconceptions is about identifying, right? So hornets and wasps, yellow jackets, they're kind of a little bit they're going to sting you. They can be aggressive. They're not, you know. So how do you tell the difference between a hornet and a bee and a fly? Because some of the mason bees look like flies, right? And, you know, you don't want to swat them if they're actually doing good for you. So the rule of thumb is, what do they land on, right? If it lands on a flower, like if those bees coming out of the dirt came up and landed on a flower, it's a bee. If it lands on your ham sandwich and starts eating it at a picnic, it's a hornet or a yellow jacket, because they're meat eaters. They eat other bugs. They're carnivores. They're not pollinators. They're meat eaters. And if it's a fly, it's going to land on dog poop, you know? So that's how you can tell by looking at that. But the misconception is that not all bees are striped. Not all bees are going to sting you.
What bees do you, because there's, I think, misconception about, like, well, a bee can only sting you once. You know, its stinger falls off. Mm. And what bees will sting you? Because it's not every bee, every kind of bee of every type. It's only specific bees.
Right. So the bees that will sting you are the honeybees. Honeybees and bumblebees. And the reason they sting you, they're not mean. They're not going after you just to be horrible and aggressive. They're protecting their hive. They have a lot to protect in that hive. The queen is the only organism that's putting out the genetic information for generations to come. So they have to protect her. They're not laying eggs. Only the queen is laying eggs, right? And then the honey. It takes so much time and energy for them to produce this honey. One honeybee can spend its whole life pollinating and gathering nectar, right, to make a teaspoon of honey. That's not a lot. So it's a huge amount of effort. And if you think about the hive with its packed full of honey and a queen bee, they need to have these defense mechanisms in order to protect somebody or something from coming to take that away. So they will sting you. And honeybees, I think, and bumblebees as well, their stingers is kind of, they're barbed, right? So they've got downward pointing little spikes. If it goes into your skin, it's not going to come out easy. And if it does come out, usually what happens is that they inject the stinger, and then it's got this little pool of venom at the bottom, and it pulses into you. That's what it stings. That's what hurts, is this venom. And then when they fly off, they leave the stinger in you, and it pretty much rips off the bottom third of their body. So they do die.
Mm.
But yellow jackets and hornets and wasps do not have barbs, so they can sting you over and over and over and over again. But mason bees and a lot of these solitary bees, they may have stingers because the stinger is the same organ that they lay eggs through, too. It's called an ovipositor.
Yeah, so is it just female bees then?
Yeah. Males pretty much do one thing. They wait for the females, they jump on the females, and they mate with them, and then they're done. They don't do anything. Nope, that's it. So all the worker bees in a honeybee hive are female, all of them. And so anatomically, they're the same as the queen, but they don't use their ovipositor to lay eggs at all. They just use them for defense mechanisms and venom. A mason bee has the, you know, can use its ovipositor as a stinger. If you mess with a mason bee, it will sting you in that it'll poke you with its stinger, but it doesn't have any venom in it, and it's not barbed, so you're really not going to feel it. And if you do feel it, what I've heard is that it feels like a mosquito bite. I've had them on me, and they've never, ever. I mean, I've never really tried to bug them either, so.
Yeah. I'll say that was part of the thing with the when I was digging into this mud and these, yeah, like, little bugs started coming out. They did kind of pick at me.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel like a sting like you would get from a bumblebee. It felt almost like a bite.
Yeah, because they don't have any venom.
So unlike bumblebees, they do not have venom. They do not live in hives that we think of traditionally.
Right.
I was also interested in how they pollinate. They pollinate differently.
Oh, they're such amazing pollinators. I wonder if it has something to do with the wildness of them. I don't know. Honeybees are very elegant, right? They're not quite as hairy. They land on a flower and they go for the nectar. That's what they're going for. It's their business to get the nectar so that they can start turning that into honey and head back to the hive. So they go for the nectar, and they might get pollen on them. If they get pollen on them, sometimes they'll take their spit and squish the pollen back into these little pouches in the back of their legs, right? So they like to kind of keep clean, but they still have pollen on them. Then they go to the next blossom, and some pollen falls off. They're good and efficient pollinators, but mason bees come in, and they're not elegant at all. They're total slobs, and they're fuzzy, so they, like, body slam the flower, and they roll around, and they get covered with pollen. And then they go to the next blossom, and they body slam that one, and they roll around. And so they pollinate 95% of the time, whereas honeybees 5% of the time. That means one mason bee can pollinate as many flowers as 100 honeybees, which is why it's so important to think of these pollinators when it comes to the fear of the colony collapse disorder and the fear of the, you know, if our honeybees die out, they are our main pollinators, but they don't have to be. I mean, we've got better ones in the wings that just don't make honey.
That don't make honey. But are there threats that are facing these mason bees, carpenter bees, the other solitary bees who do pollinate?
Mites are an issue. So in the book I talk about, you know, adding a new hive and changing things out. Some people actually take the tubes out in the fall and open them up and rinse the cocoons and keep them in the refrigerator. Yeah, you don't have to do that. You know, pesticides are a real issue, right? The things that you spray on your plants in order to kill bugs, you know, if we think about it, they're killing bugs, but those bugs have the same chemical composition as we do. We're just much bigger. It's still hurting us. So that'll hurt the bees as well. And I also, as there's a section in the book that has different sprays that you can use that are made out of plants that are not going to hurt anybody, but they're going to keep the bugs away from your plants. Like, you know, you use garlic, you know, churned up in a potion of garlic and even a biodegradable soap and water, and it's going to protect your plants from being eaten by anything.
All right. Well, if you want to encourage a mason bee, or even perhaps a bumblebee, or whatever kind of bee you're trying to get, what should you be putting in your garden? What do those bees really like to pollinate, and what kind of amenities do they need?
It's different for every area, right? So whatever wild bee is in the area likes a particular kind of flower that is found in the area, right? So around here, I would say talk to a garden center and find out what the native species are, because they love native species. They even have seed packs that are meant for pollinators. They'll grow flowers that are really good for them. But it's interesting because they don't see the same spectrum as we do. We see red, orange, yellow, blue, green, violet, right? Roy G. Biv. Bees, they slide up a little bit. They don't see reds so much. They will see orange, yellow, blue, green, violet, and ultraviolet. So it slides up. So flowers that look white to us often have these ultraviolet patterns in them that are like, come all, you know, all you can eat, 24-hour dining, you know. So I would say steer up in that color. But all bees need water, but you don't want to put just a bowl of water out there because they could drown in it. So what I've done is I've used the bottom plate of a potted plant, you know, a shallow dish, and you put water in that, but you put marbles and pebbles and maybe even a stick in it so that you kind of give them beachfront property. You give them something they can land on solidly above the water, but that they can make their way to the water and not drown. Mason bees will need that. They also need mud. They need to have damp mud. We have a kind of very clay-like soil in the corner, and so I just made sure I kept that wet through the summer last year, just so that when they needed it, they could get to it. It's amazing how fast that the little water dish evaporates, too. You got to fill that up every day.
All right, so if you're looking for bees, water, mud if you're looking for a mason bee, and then
flowers.
This book?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today, Lynn.
Well, thank you for having me.
Lynn Brunell is the author of Turn This Book Into a Beehive, and if you are interested in doing just that, you can go to WUWM.com to see our beehive and learn how to make your own. Our conversation with Brunell first aired in May. And that wraps up the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.